Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like monks at the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love.
Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James, this is Pete.
G'day everyone.
It is episode 52, years worth of podcasts, and it is the 23rd of March. We've got a huge show for you guys coming up. We're going to be talking to Dennis Prager, the founder of PragerU. Obviously, you guys might have seen those really popular YouTube channels. 1.6 billion views, was it?
1.2 billion.
Thank
60%
you,
under the age of 35.
Yeah. Pete with the stats there. So really cool chat about freedom of speech on campus, a lot of other topics as well. Really looking forward to that.
So that's over two parts, isn't it, James?
Yes. So part one this week, part two next week. But we'll also have this week an interview with new MP, Andrew Hasty, just talking about what his path to the political world and what he'd like to do in his career in politics.
It's been a big week in interviews, hasn't
it? Yeah, exactly. And it's been a big week in news around the world, Pete. By the way, Dennis Prager, tall dude. I don't know if you guys like out there listening saw the photo we put on the IPA Facebook page yesterday. Tall dude.
He was standing on a phone book though.
And we were standing in a pit. I just did want to read one bit of feedback. So I sent the photo to my lefty housemate who I've referred to on the show a few times. And he sends back, your mate is sweating it up in you. So how do we feel about that one?
Oh, Pete? Mate?
Yeah.
I don't know. Well, am I?
I don't know. I just wanted to see if I could rattle your cage. But the cage is unrattled by the looks of it.
I don't mind.
Okay, cool. So, huge week of news this week. So, we'll start off with this one. I mean, it's not the biggest story in the world, but it certainly Pete and I had a bit of fun with it. Pete, could you talk us through what happened with Liberty Victoria this week?
Oh, right. Okay. That's right. So, this week, Liberty Victoria, a little organisation in Australia, in Victoria, which is a civil rights organisation, they say, civil liberties organisation, awarded the Young Voltaire Award. I hope I've got that right. Mm-hmm. Young Voltaire Award for freedom of speech to Yasmin Abdul Magid, which has caused a little bit of controversy around the place. Simon Breeny cracked it? No, he didn't crack it. He gave a strongly worded statement to the newspaper.
He was disappointed, not mad.
He was disappointed.
Yeah.
I'm struggling to recall anything that Miss Abdul Magid has done to defend freedom of speech. He called Liberty Victoria a fraudulent outfit. Where was Liberty Victoria? Fraudulent outfit, that's quite...
You know what, I'm going to upgrade this. He did have a crack.
Yeah. Where was Liberty Victoria when Bill Leek was being chastised by the Australian Human Rights Commission, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, you can see that on their website. But, yeah, not my first choice for someone who would, you know...
Yeah.
I mean, if being unpopular means you get a free speech award, where's mine?
Pete should be the seven-time reigning champion.
Oh, heaps of people hate her, so...
Pete's hit the nail on the head. So when Liberty Victoria discussed to the Australian why Yasmin won, or at least, you know, why they put out the press release that the Australian ran with, the quote is, "Yasmin is sometimes provocative, but the hate she receives is despicable and disproportionate. Despite being on the receiving end of personal attacks and threats of death and sexual violence, Yasmin courageously continues to give voice to a cross-section of society that is not well represented in the media or in public debate." Literally none of that has anything to do with freedom of speech.
Yeah, it's like she's courageous.
Yeah, she gets hate online. And
which
she shouldn't, obviously. Like, you could say, like, oh, she deserves an award for open debate if you were so inclined, but freedom of speech, no. So I think if I were Liberty Victoria, I would change the category slightly to, like, the Young Voltaire Award for people the organisers most want a selfie with.
Yeah.
Does seem to be who they
people go. They like. Yeah. They gave it last year, so that was the Young Award. They gave
And Magda Szymanski got the big Voltaire Award.
Yeah.
It's like... Yeah, come on.
They gave it last year, so they've improved, as we said. In hopefully not miss, they gave it last year to Gillian Triggs,
yes.
Who like legitimately doesn't like freedom of speech. Like she literally said, people can unfortunately say what they want around their kitchen table.
Yeah, exactly.
So they're getting better.
They're learning, but maybe in about 15 years, I might give it to someone who's actually stood up for the fundamental right of freedom of expression.
Yeah,
but not holding my breath. So next up, This is a very huge story around the world. It's just breaking now. So Cambridge Analytica, you guys might have heard this. Cambridge Analytica is an organization that sold a lot of people's personal Facebook data.
Mm.
And they sold it to the Trump campaign. And Steve Bannon used to be on the, like, have some links to Cambridge Analytica. But it's basically just like Facebook sold, like some organization got people's Facebook data and they sold it. And people have put the word Trump in the headline. And everyone's lost their minds, which is basically what you do. If you've got a tiny story you want it to be big, find a way to connect it to Trump, and then you'll get the international traction. So everyone's freaking out. It's like in this whole idea of like, oh, Trump manipulated the last election by getting people to vote for him. So the thing is, everyone acted legally. Like everyone signed up to this. So Cambridge Analytica originally put out like a your online personality quiz, and to take the quiz, you had to sign away some of your personal details on Facebook. I mean, just by clicking the yes, I agree, which everyone, no one ever reads. And then Cambridge Analytica had the ability to sell that data off to third-party companies. So all of this is completely legal.
Yeah.
But because it went to Trump, now it's evil.
And as I'm sure you're about to say, when Obama did it, it was cool.
Yeah. So Obama did this exact same thing in 2012, and everyone's like, this is so innovative. Yeah. What a genius. Second Trump does it, pure evil.
Well,
it's like, well, both of them are kind of weird, and people should not be a little more guarded with what they... Like, not weird as in it's weird that society is so... Yeah, you know, I am willing to sign away where I live and who my friends are.
Yeah.
Just so I can find out if I'm that kind of person online.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like don't do the quiz on Facebook to find out what kind of person
sandwich
you are.
For a start. Please have my personal credit card details. I need to know what type of sandwich I am.
And people just...
Reuben. Interesting.
People will just go on, you know, about, oh, Facebook's selling my data. It's like, you don't have to be on Facebook.
Yeah, seriously. You can log off at any time.
And, you know, you don't have to have an iPhone. Get off the grid, mate.
Yeah, exactly.
Mate.
That's your off-the-grid profile going there.
Oh, well, I don't care if companies know where I live and stuff.
I care a little bit. It's a little weird. What do you reckon, Nana?
I don't know. Personally, I don't really care. I don't actually do the quizzes.
You know what kind of sandwich you are already.
Yeah. Like,
what kind of sandwich are you, Nana?
Ham sandwich. I don't do quizzes.
Very popular.
Yeah.
Righto.
Yeah, so like everyone was like looking up what Facebook knows about you at the IPA yesterday. Mm. Facebook knows I really like sport and I live in Melbourne, and I'm just like, probably need a few more diverse interests.
So you need a hobby, James.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe I'll get into woodworking, get a lot of woodworking adverts. Cool, so we'll move on to another story, Pete.
Woodwork. All right, yes. So Clive Hamilton is a lefty academic, previously ran for the Greens, had an excellent piece in The Age this week about... identity politics and how identity politics was a preoccupation of the left to its detriment, which was a very good thing to say. And in fact, a lot of lefty academics more and more are coming out against identity politics, which is good because it's stupid. And so the reason why he wrote that...
And stick around for what Dennis Prager says about identity politics, because speaking of having a crack, this... Yeah, not a fan.
Came off the long run. anyway, so the reason why he had this piece in the paper was because he wrote a book about the influence of the Chinese Communist Party in Australia, and... Tim Suit Fomasan, Human Rights Commissioner.
Well done.
Well done, Pete. Good pronunciation.
I did stuff that up. apologies. Criticised him, called him racist, basically. And called it a racist book, sorry. I shouldn't misquote him. Said it reminded him of the Yellow Peril, the idea of the Yellow Peril.
Yeah, so, but basically trying to paint him with a racist brush to denigrate the findings of the book.
Yeah, because he was saying Chinese people are harassed by the Chinese government in Australia.
If you can't see the racism in that, then you're not trying.
Anyway. Have a read.
Yeah, have a read of it. It's really cool. We've got a link to it in Hey, What Did I Miss? And I do love Clive Hamilton constantly referring to all the Chinese Australians that he ran the book by.
Yeah.
And it's like, so you can't say I've got a Chinese friend, but you can also say it when it suits you. You know how everyone's like really like, oh, whenever you say, oh, I've got a gay friend, but I'm still against gay marriage.
Yeah.
It's starting to turn on itself.
Yeah.
But anyway, it is a good article and you guys should read it. We'll move on to another one. So this one also broke on Wednesday. So Mark Meacham, or better known for some reason as Count Dankula, his Scottish YouTube channel.
That sounds like a name you would have.
Count Dankula.
Yeah.
I mean,
I'm not saying it's you.
It's not me.
But
I kind of see it. But anyway, so Count Dankula, this YouTube, he calls himself well, I probably can't say it on air, it is a family show, but suffice to say, he's a bit of an online troll, and he's pretty self-admitting that he is an online troll. He likes just getting under people's skin. And he made a video 2 years ago, and his idea was, to put it in his own words, his idea was that his girlfriend was obsessed with her new dog, and she thought it was really cute, and she loved taking photos of it, so he's like, I want to turn this dog into the least cute thing I could think of, a Nazi. So he spent an afternoon trying to teach the dog to do a Nazi salute whenever he would say Sieg Heil. So, you know, not the greatest guy in the world, and pretty stupid video.
Yeah, he's an appalling human being.
Yeah, well, Pete... Everyone's having a crack these days. I need to start forming bigger opinions. But anyway, what happened next is pretty chilling. So he, on Wednesday, was found guilty of committing a hate crime in Britain, and he is awaiting sentencing. So, yeah, they've literally destroyed... freedom of speech is dead in Britain, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah.
Hold on. But hate crime because of the video?
Hate crime because of the video. So... Because
they couldn't arrest
the dog. It's like anti-Semitic...
So
I don't think the dog is up to date with World War II history. The dog's not talking. But yeah, so it's basically like he committed a hate crime by posting the video. It's really anti-Semitic and offensive in nature. And people were saying that, people spoke against him in the witness testimony saying how offensive the video was. And he got sentenced for a hate crime, which is disgusting.
Convicted.
Yeah, so here's what, he put out a Facebook status after he was found guilty. While awaiting sentencing, the court has ordered that I meet with a court social worker for an assessment as to whether or not a restriction of liberty order will be placed on me. This would involve a GPS tracking device being attached to me and being placed under house arrest. Yeah. So, like, literally, you have to stay home because of what you did online.
Yeah, for a joke, which was very a poor joke.
I mean,
joke,
no one's
still
doing it.
It's still a joke.
Yeah.
That his dog did.
Yeah, but the other part is, like, you know how free speech advocates like us will always say, if you start taking these absolute weirdos into court, you sort of legitimize their opinions?
Mm. Yeah.
I think there's going to be a lot of people trying to get their dog to do that salute. Just, yeah. No, not broadcasting it, but they're just like, how hard could it be?
Yeah.
So, you know, you've got a lot more of it now on your hands, is what I'm saying.
So what happened with the dog?
Good question, Anna.
Yeah. I think the dog is innocent.
Okay.
And, you know.
They put their GPS as well.
Yeah, the dog has to... The dog's been sentenced to read a few more World War II books and think about what it did.
Yeah.
Cool. So, any other stories, Pete?
No. Well, I mean, yes, but they're the best ones.
Oh, okay, cool. Also, big week for the IPA. So, we've released two videos with Resonance Star and good friend of the podcast, Gideon Rosner.
That's right.
Sorry, both of which you can watch on our Facebook page and on our website. So, basically, the first one, if I recall, so Gideon wanted to break down, so British Columbia, province in Canada. Oh,
yeah, this is good.
Went from like one of the worst economies in Canada to one of the best.
Yep.
And grew personal incomes 20% in real terms in some...
Over a couple of decades.
Yep. So that was like, what's turned it around? Surprise, surprise. It is a massive red tape reduction program. Two out, one in rule. So basically for every new regulation you have to take out two.
Yeah.
It's a really cool video. You guys should watch it. Yeah.
It's an incredible story.
Yeah, yeah. So that's on our Facebook page and YouTube and website. And also you can check out yesterday. So obviously Sally McManus, you would have seen... Secretary of the Australian...
ACTU,
that's it. Gave a speech at the National Press Club. The union movement called it the most important speech in a decade. So if I have one word of advice for the union movement, it is don't organise the most important speech in a generation the day before AFL gets back.
That's right.
It's not... Like, no one's covered it.
No one's thinking about it.
No cut through at all. But anyway, she was saying how... the union movement now is going to go after the sharing economy to protect workers' rights. But obviously, sharing economy is a very important thing and should be supported, which is what Gideon's saying.
As he points out in the video, sorry.
Go ahead.
A third of Uber drivers in Brisbane were unemployed before Uber employed them.
Yeah, exactly, which is what I was about to say. Really fascinating stat. But also, it's just, you know, the ACTU cares about members. Like, they don't actually care about the people outside a job.
Yeah.
And it's not like Uber drivers are forced into it by this company. They just close the app if they want to stop driving.
Yeah.
So, anyway, watch the video. Will the ACTU go after Tinder next?
Mm.
Stand aside. Cool. So, if you want to watch that video, go on our Facebook page and website. So, we'll now go to our interviews with Dennis Prager and Andrew Hasty. But before we do, we should probably talk membership.
Yes, guys. So, if you like what we just share and you would like to know what Tim Sooth from my son saying.
Sooth from my son. Sooth from my son.
Yeah, well, Tim Sooth.
You are now banned from having a go at Pete for poor pronunciation. I'm putting you on a 2-week hiatus.
Oh, I'm putting the GPS on me then.
Tim Sooth from my son.
Tim Sooth from my son. Books? No, what was that again?
He wrote a piece. That was critical. Do you not listen to what we say?
The dog lost me there. Sorry.
You're still thinking about the dog.
I was still thinking about the dog. I was like, what's happening with the dog? Okay, anyway. So if you want to know...
it's so fascinating looking at how Nina works. It's like the most important free speech case we'll have all year. She's like, so could the dog be sentenced? Yeah. Is it happy? Is it getting well fed?
You can see her.
I don't
not
even
listening.
Have a dog.
I've always, like, she looks like she's not listening, but now
yeah.
it's definitely proven that she doesn't.
As much as I love this, we do have to get to these interviews.
Yep.
Yeah, so if you go, start again. If you like what we do.
All right. Nina. Okay, I'll do the podcast thing. We'll come back to you. Okay, God. If you guys like this podcast, make sure you are subscribed on iTunes, SoundCloud. You can also stream it off our website and through our Hey What Did I Miss email. If you like us on iTunes, make sure you leave in that 5-star review. We are clocking them up very quickly. It's really cool to see, and it helps us out with the rankings. So, Nina, attempt number 5. How can people join as an IPA member?
If you want to join, just visit our website, ipa.org.au, and click on the join button. And starting as low as $22 per year, you can become a member, and you will be receiving 4 free copies of IPA reviews and also free access to weekly emails. Hey, what did I miss?
Well done, Nina.
Thank you very much.
Go to those interviews. Okay, we are now joined by author, radio host, one of the world's most influential conservative thinkers, and founder of the extremely popular YouTube channel PragerU, which has over 1.2 billion total video views. Dennis Prager, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm delighted to be with you, as you can well imagine.
Thank you. You are in Melbourne with the United Israel Appeal, which brings together people to help raise money and awareness for the disadvantaged and underprivileged in Israel. Why is United Israel Appeal as a cause so important to you?
I believe that Israel is the moral litmus test, which a role that the Jews have played historically. It's a lousy role to play, being the canary in the mine. You die, and then you're the canary. You die as soon as there are noxious fumes, and the miners then know, there are noxious fumes. We have to fight them. Then the Jews have played the role of the canary. Israel is the only state on earth targeted for extinction. Unless one believes in tremendous coincidence, it is not a coincidence that the only state targeted for extinction is also the only Jewish state. What Jew hatred has simply morphed from the individual to the state. So you don't get many people who hate every Jew like the Nazis did. Instead, you have people who hate the Jewish state. So it's simply gone from micro to macro. And it is an amazing thing. Israel is smaller than El Salvador. And the United Nations has spent more time condemning Israel than any other country on earth. So it's an existential battle for Israel's existence. And I feel a moral obligation to make people aware of that.
Mm-hmm. So your video on the Israeli-Arab conflict was, I believe, the most popular video that PragerU has done. Is that correct?
No, believe it or not, by happenstance, as it happens, I may be redundant, the most popular video, which hit over 50 million views, is on something that would have no interest to you as non-Americans, and that is about the American Electoral College. We don't vote popular vote. We vote by state. If you win the state by 10 votes, you win all the electoral votes of that state. The founders of the United States wanted states to retain power and not just gigantic cities, and that would end all elections in effect. Nobody would campaign in smaller states. Yeah. You just win California, New York, and you basically have done all you need to do.
Yeah. I guess candidates are still not campaigning in smaller states.
Well, Hillary Clinton found out that was a mistake. You know, Michigan and Pennsylvania and so on. I mean, they're not small states by any means, but they're smaller than the big ones, than the biggest. In any event, that because right after the Trump election, there was such an outcry on the left against the Electoral College, people wanted to know, where can we go on the internet to find reasons for it?
Yeah.
Bravo, we were there already, having made two by this woman who works very diligently on the subject, Tara Ross, and it went viral, and super viral, hyper viral. And we are convinced that it changed, the polls in the country changed in a few weeks. And given that 50 million people in America at least saw the video, it clearly had an impact. So that's the second, interestingly, is I believe the second most popular. My Middle East, I think, is the third one. So you're right about it being very high. And by the way, I only give 10% of the videos just for your viewers' interest. But the second most is, what did slavery cause the American Civil War? And we had a professor of history at the U.S. Military Academy, West Point, give the course. And of course, the answer is yes. That's the reason the South seceded, slavery. interestingly, the left loves us for that video. And I'm not quite sure why. Who really has denied that it was slavery? I don't know if it's a left-right issue, but the left said, well, if there's one thing Prager University got right, it's the Civil War video. Okay, fine.
But as you say, the Middle Eastern conflicts one is very popular. I think it is most viewed on YouTube, maybe not on other platforms. Why do you think that video has caught so many people's imagination and has become so the ideas that you said there, which you know sound basic when you say them, but they're clearly very revolutionary to some people?
Well, I think you answered it in the last sentence. They're revolutionary to many people. The propaganda against Israel that saturates the Western world, indeed the whole world, is you can drown in it. I debated at Oxford. That's another video that was very popular. It's not a PragerU video. It's just my video at Oxford. And believe it or not, the topic I debated at Oxford, at the famous Oxford Union, was who is the greater obstacle to Middle East peace, Israel or Hamas? And as I said at Oxford, I said it would be as if in the late 1930s, there was a debate at Oxford, who was the greater obstacle to European peace, Hitler or Churchill? And who would vote Churchill? And yet, this was a debate at Oxford, and indeed, the side that said Israel was the bigger, in other words, a democratic state was voted, and I pointed this out, for the first time in history, a democratic, free country was voted the reason for war, not the totalitarian terror state. It is almost literally a broken moral compass. So if somebody comes along and just clearly says, wait a minute, black is black, white is white, green is green, and yellow is yellow, and if it's done logically, which is all I work on is logic and reason, it obviously will have a following. And my thesis in that video is one side wants the other side dead. That's the line I keep showing. And that's the case. If Israel disarmed tomorrow, we are burning all our armaments and we will fight no longer, what would happen? The next day there would be a genocide. If you deny that, you are lying to yourself. I mean, that's truly... You're irredeemable if you deny that.
And history shows that.
What they want. They want genocide in Israel. The rape and torture and murder would be Holocaustian. But now imagine if the Palestinians said, you know what, and Hezbollah and Hamas, you know what, we're burning all our armaments and we will fight no more. What would happen the next day in that case? Peace. Peace. If that doesn't persuade someone what the cause, the casus belli, the cause of war is, nothing will.
All right. Well, I'm glad you mentioned Oxford University because we want to talk about one of your favourite topics, which is free speech and particularly free speech on university campuses. We've seen a decline of free speech across the Western world. Why do you think that is?
The left has never valued freedom. Liberals have valued freedom. I make a very strong distinction, and I think all of us who are not on the left must, between liberals and leftists. Mm-hmm. Liberals are pro-free speech. Leftists have never been, because they are not for any form of freedom. Leftism is as totalitarian as a country will allow it to be. It isn't always totalitarian because it doesn't have the power. But where it has the power, it suppresses those with whom it differs, period. And, or you would say full stop, right?
We would say full stop, yeah.
Yeah, so I'll say full stop too.
It took me ages to work out what period meant.
Yes, no, I could imagine. So I studied in England for a year, I picked up a lot. This is why the university is so repressed. And I tell people who are in the middle, all you need to know about the left is the university. See what they do when other people say things. You guys need to follow Amy Wax, W-A-X. She is a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania. University of Pennsylvania is considered one of the Ivy League universities, so it's one of the most prestigious in the United States. The woman wrote a piece for the Philadelphia Inquirer. The University of Pennsylvania is in Philadelphia. And she wrote this last summer, she wrote it with another a law professor from San Diego, that in fact America did well by having middle-class bourgeois values, and that they were their basic, if you wish, liberal values. You know, for example, obviously freedom, but that, for example, people should get married and they should also have a child after they get married. Marriage was valued, having children after marriage was valued, hard work was valued, and these values are good, and we need them again. We need them reinstated, as it were. She was condemned by half of her fellow professors at the University of Pennsylvania faculty, and now, and you can read this, the Wall Street Journal editorial just on this, she also just said that affirmative action does not help blacks. And that's why the black graduation rate is lower than others, because they, by changing standards, lowering standards for black students, you have made it much harder for them to do well, as it would be true for me or anybody. If you lowered standards to accept me, I wouldn't do so well. And Black Lives Matter, which is a truly fascistic, violent movement, has said, I'm paraphrasing, we warn the University of Pennsylvania, if you do not fire this professor, we will disrupt your campus. This we're a week away from the deadline, but this is what the left does. The Black Lives Matter, which is a truly dangerous organization to liberty and to indeed to human life, I believe, is a hero of the left. They have been given $100 million by left-wing organizations, by either the Ford Foundation or another one. I mean, it even so-called mainstream. So the university reflects the left's suppression of free speech and of freedom generally. And why do they do it? Because they can't win on the merits of argument.
You mentioned in this speech that you made during last week, I think, or maybe a few weeks ago, actually, to the Conservative College Students Action Summit, this distinction between leftism and liberals. I thought that was a really interesting point. Do you mind going through
Sure.
that again for our listeners?
Well, freedom of speech is one perfect example of a left-liberal difference. The most dramatic is race. Many American campuses have a black dormitory, all-black dorm. You have to be black to live in that dormitory. This is the antithesis of liberalism, which believed in racial integration, which believed that race, the ideal is to be colorblind. The left is the antithesis of colorblind. The left is the most race-honoring ideology since the Nazis. Now, I'm not comparing them to the Nazis. They're not building concentration camps or gas chambers. I know that. But in terms of race, the last big ideology to honor race were the Nazis. And now the left. They honor race. There is a list. People can follow my tweets and they can get this list. I actually put it out in a tweet last week. University of California has put out a list of what are called microaggressions. Statements people make that they may not think are racist but really are. Here is an example. If someone says, I only believe in one race, the human race, that is a microaggression. On the left, to say there's only one race, the human race, what is a beautiful concept, it's a beautiful liberal concept and conservative one, that is now considered racist. That's a classic liberal left difference. It's embodied in a man who I'm sure is known to some Australians, Alan Dershowitz, professor of law at Harvard University, lifelong Democrat, lifelong Hillary Clinton supporter, well, not lifelong, but as long as she's been in politics, and liberal. And he said, and it will be in the film that Adam Carolla and I are putting out called No Safe Spaces, he said, so you will see it, but I play it on my radio show, which by the way, anyone in Australia can hear if they just listen to the app. You don't want to hear it live, it's 3 a.m.
You got up for that this morning, didn't you?
I did indeed, yes.
That's commitment.
It was commitment, and I kept saying it to my audience. God, am I committed to you? And he said, I'm a lifelong liberal Democrat. My enemy is the left, not the conservative, not the right. Liberals do not understand that the enemy of liberalism is not conservatism. The enemy of liberalism is leftism.
I think that's actually an emerging trend. There are more kind of lifelong left-wing academics and commentators who are coming out against what we call identity politics and leftism.
Good, I hope you're right. Identity politics is racism. Yeah. So it's a cute word for racism.
Going back to your point that it's now considered a microaggression to say you only believe in one race, the human race. You pointed out in a recent debate at UC Berkeley that had that been the predominant view of people in the 1600s, 1700s, there probably wouldn't have been a slave trade, which I think is such an interesting thing.
That's right.
That it's now considered racist. What would have destroyed the most racist thing we've done?
That's correct. If everybody believed there's only one race, you could not have justified black slavery.
Not at all. So also in that debate,
for reminding me. It was a good point.
Blew me away when I forget
a lot of my good points, so thank you.
Yeah. Right. I was watching the video going, yeah, I need to use that. I'm going to steal that.
Enjoy it.
All right, cool. Just for our viewers and listeners that haven't seen it yet, so about 4 days ago, they released a video of a debate you had with two students at UC Berkeley.
Yeah.
And you raised the topic that conservative students are now too scared to speak in universities. And they, to me, ludicrously brought up that if there was that for conservatives, it was just as bad for people on the left. And to me, I was kind of getting the feel from them that no conservative student had ever actually come up to them in private and said, I really felt out of it in that class, or I didn't feel like I could contribute. So what do you say that conservative students are now so silenced that even their friends aren't even aware that they're being silenced? It's the marginalization.
I wrote a weekly syndicated column in the U.S., it's obviously on the internet, so anyone can read it. But I wrote about this. I taught Jewish history at Brooklyn College. That was my first full-time job, so to speak. So I wrote a book on anti-Semitism. So I know a lot about that subject, and there is a name that most Jews are aware of, but most non-Jews are not. It's called Marano. Marano is a Spanish name for Jews during the Spanish Inquisition, which was in the 1500s, 1600s, 1300s. It went about 300 years, but it was at its height at the end of the 15th century. And Jews would hide their being Jewish at home, not tell anyone, and they would act Catholic publicly. What we have in America today, and I wouldn't be surprised if you have it here as well, is Marranos who are conservative. On the outside, they are just like everyone else, and privately, they're conservative, or even, God forbid, a Trump supporter. Let me give you a really dramatic example. Last year, I conduct orchestras as an avocation. I love music, and I'm obviously immersed in it. So I conducted the Santa Monica Symphony Orchestra at the Walt Disney Concert Hall. It was a great honor for me, and it was a great night. And there were charges made against me of being a racist and fascist. How could an orchestra play for a racist and fascist? Because any conservative is immediate. So you're not even allowed to conduct an orchestra if you're a conservative. So listen to this. The New York Times covered this quote-unquote controversy of a conservative conducting the orchestra of a very left-wing city at a major concert hall. And it was a hatchet job piece, which is not at all. And I wrote about how they report things in another article. Okay, back to this. So I got email after email from members of orchestras all across America. I mean, I know orchestras, the biggest orchestras, the most famous, most prestigious. Dear Mr. Prager, I just want you to know I am a Marano in my own orchestra. Really? A violist from one of the most prestigious orchestras in the country, obviously I won't mention her name, who's been a violist for 40 years, said none of the members of the orchestra know that I am conservative.
That's pretty telling.
Yeah.
We get contacted by academics in Australia, like the Institute of Public Affairs, saying that they're a conservative and that they're so glad that there's one organisation that makes those comments, but they, so none of their colleagues know either that they're conservative.
That's right. That's exactly. So you have it here.
Yeah, yeah.
I would assume.
Okay, we are now joined by Andrew Hasty, the member for Canning. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you, James, Peter.
All right, brilliant. So you're our first guest that's actually seen combat, which is pretty cool. What did you learn about yourself and about leadership in your time in the Australian Armed Forces?
Well, I think that moral courage is more important than physical courage. When you have adrenaline running through your body, it's easy to do brave things, but when you have to make tough decisions and everyone's watching and there's a level of moral conflict within you, it's much harder to show moral courage. So I think I agree with people who say that it's a higher form of courage. And I think moral courage is something that politicians have to exercise every day. And I think it's something that we should be cultivating in younger Australians because it's essential in public life.
So just for our listeners who might not know, where did you serve, Andrew?
So I served in the 2nd Cavalry Regiment and the Special Air Service Regiment. And in those two units, I deployed to Afghanistan a couple of times, first in 2009, briefly in 2012, and then for an extended period in 2013 with the Special Operations Task Group. And so, especially in 2013, where there was a lot more strategic ambiguity about where Afghanistan was heading, there was a lot of pressure on us tactically, and I found myself having to make a lot of decisions that required moral courage.
Interesting. That's a very interesting perspective. So what made you decide to become a politician?
I'd always been interested in politics. I grew up in a household where my father was a public leader in his community, and I saw what he did, and I always sort of wanted to emulate him. I got drawn to big ideas when I studied philosophy at university, and I just got to a point in life where I was sick and tired of, well, it was the Rudd Gillard Rudd years, which kind of radicalized me, if you like, and prompted me to join the Liberal Party because I thought I needed to make a contribution, and that's how I ended up in politics.
What specifically about those years was it? Was it like, you know, economics or social policy?
There's a lot to choose from.
Yeah. It was, look, it was a combination of economics, not so much social policy, although, you know, I was watching closely, but it really crystallized for me when I went overseas. And I guess it's not so much a reflection on the Labor Party. It's a reflection on our political class altogether that I didn't think much strategic thought had been put into what we were doing in Afghanistan. And of course, the parameters that we were given as soldiers affected what we did tactically. Mm-hmm. And so I felt the brunt of bad policy on the ground in Afghanistan. And so I thought, okay, I can make a contribution. Having been at the pointy end, I want to now go upstream to politics and be involved in policy formulation.
Sorry to ask like a fourth question in a row here, but could we just unpick that for a second? What specifically, what specific bad policies do you mean? Like what kind of tech?
Well, for example, we were transitioning Afghanistan back to the Afghan government. And so we were over there doing train, advise, assist with the Afghan National Army. And that required us to go out into the field with Afghans. And they started imposing force ratios on us. And so when I was there, it went from 50% to 75%. So before I've even gone out and planned a mission, I'm being told by higher command because of a policy decision, you can only take out 25% of your Australian force element. So I was having to make decisions. Okay, do I leave the medic on the helicopter or do I drop the medic off the helicopter?
Okay, yep.
Do I leave the engineer on? But we might have an IED, so I need him there. And frankly, that's not how you win wars. You've got to be pragmatic. And I just felt we were being... our hands were being tied behind our back because of bad policy.
Well, absolutely. So we'll move on to your political career. Now, obviously, the last 6 months or so has been there's been a lot of talk about gay marriage, and you were pretty vocal and talking about your sort of your Christian beliefs.
Hmm.
I just want to get a feel for what values do you get from your Christianity?
Well, first of all, I think every individual, I've called the principle Imago Dei, which is Latin for the image of God. I think every individual has inherent worth and dignity. And so it doesn't matter what colour, what gender, what sexuality you have, you're worthy of respect. And I'm called to love my neighbour. And so that's kind of the informing principle of how I try to do politics. But of course, you know, like a lot of people, my views on marriage are informed by my religious belief. But of course, in the public square, I made my arguments from natural law as distinct from my Christian faith. Although in my speech on the Marriage Act last year in December, I did say, hey, you know, I do have a Christian belief and that shapes my view of marriage. But when I make the argument, I want to carry people who have no religion, religious affiliation at all, and that's what public policy is about.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you feel your Christian faith? I mean, obviously, you're talking about it from a natural law perspective, but sure. You know, the media does go with the Christian element. Do you feel that the Christian faith makes you more relatable to voters, or does it make it harder for you to win over people?
I think people appreciate. They like the fact that they know where they stand with you. So Monday, a woman came up to me in my electorate and she said, look, I disagreed with your marriage, but I just appreciate the fact that you made the case and you stood your ground, and it means that I can trust you because at least I know that you're principled. And I think that's what people want in politicians, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, that's why I have a lot of respect for the guys who went hard on the yes side, because I knew where they stood. You know, Dean Smith, I had some pretty strong discussions with him about this subject, but at the end of the day, we saw eye to eye. We both knew where we stood, and that made our relationship a lot easier.
Yeah, absolutely.
We do a lot of work here at the IPA on the censorious nature of speech on university campuses these days. James did some research on Wikipedia, very in-depth research on your motivation for joining the military, which allegedly was because of the anti-American sentiment on campuses after 9/11.
Yeah, it sort of said that you didn't like the vibe of what you were hearing at Chutes. And
yeah, that's right.
Oh, so it is right.
Yeah, it's true.
Wikipedia, come through again.
Yeah.
Got me through uni, gets me through an interview.
Exactly right. Look, it's true, after 9/11, I was doing philosophy at the University of New South Wales, which was actually a great way to get educated. But I know after 9/11, I remember sitting in tutorials and people applying the moral equivalence argument. This America had it coming. What did they expect? And I didn't think it was that clear cut. And I just felt less and less like this was the place where I needed to be.
Mm.
And of course, when we started seeing troops going to Afghanistan, at that time I was actually considering being a journalist. And it just seemed so exciting and, you know, the lure of adventure dragged me into defence.
Okay. And so based on your experiences then and your observations now, do you think that kind of censorious nature has got worse on universities much over the last 20 years?
I think so. And I think university students back in 2001, 2002 were less glass-jawed. They're more glass-jawed now.
Okay, yep.
You know, they were less shouty. There was certainly that prevailing postmodern view that was taking hold. But certainly it feels a lot more emotional now, I would say. That's my observation.
Yeah. I was at uni from 2003, so similar time. And, I didn't go to that many classes, but especially at the start. But I would say...
What was the pub scene at uni, mate?
It's rock solid. But, I'd tend to agree with that.
Yeah, and certainly Glassdoor. Like, I just got out of uni about a few years ago, and, yeah, it's pretty tough to sort of discuss these issues. I'm usually, like, the one guy against 12, and I'll raise points that none of them have actually heard before because they never actually engage with the other side. Like, I don't know, the one I always bring up, we were talking about the French Revolution, and the guy was saying, oh, the terror didn't go far enough. They were so close to creating the perfect society. I just remember going like, mate, how many people thought they were counter-revolutionaries before the guy taps them on the shoulder and sends them to the guillotine?
Exactly.
And also, like, can you guarantee that you're going to be on the right side of the government your entire life? Like, the government's never going to change its mind about something. Anyway, I'm having four-year-old arguments.
You mentioned the right side. You know, those people who say, oh, I'm on the right side of the history, you're on the wrong side of history. They have a Marxist twang
absolutely.
When they say that. That's an argument I really, really don't like. Nothing is inevitable.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing that might be inevitable in people's eyes is your rise to the top of the Liberal Party. And you're sort of seen as a sort of the next leader of the conservative faction of the Liberal Party. And that's coming pretty early in your political career. How are you dealing with those sort of expectations? I know my dad has been pretty vocal on this side of things, so...
Look, I just keep doing what I'm doing. There's a reason I'm staying off Twitter. I don't actually have access to my Facebook account, although I approve what goes on there.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's bad to read a lot of your own press, and there's a lot of negative feedback about me as well. And I just want to keep trusting my instincts and doing what I'm doing. I gave a speech recently with James Patterson where I talked about how I actually call myself a libcon. You know, as Milton Friedman described a classical liberal, I think that's what I am. The media like to give you labels, and so I'm a conservative now.
Okay.
But certainly the point I was trying to make in that speech was that, you know, we both embrace what Thomas Sowell calls the constrained vision, right?
Mm-hmm.
Our politics is shaped by that. So we have a lot in common. We shouldn't be talking about a division between the Liberal Party.
So the Liberal Party, as we've seen recently, has been not doing so well in the polls, the coalition. Why do you think that is?
My sense of it is that Australians as a whole are discontented with both major parties, or at least Liberal and Labor Party. You see that in the primary vote. There's just a general malaise, which I think took hold during the Rudd-Gillard-Rudd years. We had all that ministerial churn with leadership changes. We did the same thing. People weren't expecting that. That's all in the past now. I'm looking forward to the future. But certainly there's a discontent that's arisen out of so many prime ministers in such a short space of time. And there's just a general cynicism. I think most of the issues that we're experiencing politically are actually reflections of the culture. We're becoming increasingly balkanized through identity politics. Social media is a driving force there,
mm-hmm.
You know, pushing us into ideological echo chambers, as it were. So we're just not talking with each other at the grassroots level, and that's reflected politically. And of course, it's reflected in news poll where discontentment is made manifest.
If I could hit you just with another question about a bit more policy stuff. We had a report out yesterday by Daniel Wilde talking about the price of ordinary household goods in Australia, yeah. Right? So, you know, wages have risen 90% over the last two decades, but the cost of housing has risen 330%, childcare 310%, electricity by 215%. Do you reckon these kind of issues are hitting the polls, or do you think it's more values type stuff?
Well, yesterday I spoke. Yeah, so people have identified cost of living pressures as a reason for why they're dissatisfied with politics. Life is getting tougher. We've had a huge downturn in WA. I have a lot of FIFO families who are already under a lot of stress with dads and mums flying away throughout the year.
Mm-hmm.
It's very disruptive to family life. And now quite a few of them have been retrenched and moved on. And so they've got mortgages they've got to pay. They've got kids who have been in local private schools, low fee paying private schools, who've had to be pulled out because of the cost of living pressures. And so all that combined has led to a general frustration with politicians. And so when they see us talking about pet issues that have no bearing on their economic well-being, they get frustrated. And that's why I think we need to get out and do more town halls. I did it last year. By the 28th, 29th town hall, I was exhausted because you just have to take it for an hour. It's pastoral. You know, politics is not just telling people about policy. It's actually pastoral and just copping the hits. And you need stamina for that. So
Very much so.
Yeah, absolutely. To bring it back to talking about why people are sort of dissatisfied with the major parties, I think you hit the nail on the head when you say it gets balkanized, it gets a little party platform-esque. And to bring it back to the woman you were talking about earlier, is like, I might have disagreed with you on gay marriage, but at least I know where you stand. I mean, I think that's how, like, you know, I don't want to sound like a sucking up to you or anything, but people like you who actually are able to talk about, this is my individual belief, this is my history, you know, there's an actual functioning human being there, whereas some other politicians don't really have that. You know, they're sort of, they've been in politics their whole lives. I think that's how we get people back to engaging with politics, like talking like actual human beings.
Yeah, and take a bit of risk. I think people are just sick of the talking points. So a lot of times, I did 30 town hall forums last year in Canning as a way of reconnecting with constituents. And a lot of the time I just say, look, I don't know. And people were happy with that.
Mm.
So that sort of flies in the face of the kind of, poll-driven, scripted politician that people seem to be sick of.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think what's happened is people have looked to government for a lot of answers and we're not giving it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's refreshing when they come and meet you in the person, I think, where you just... And they ask you a question, you say, I don't know the answer. And they go, oh, okay.
As opposed to just saying innovative and agile. And just hoping the issue goes away.
pick any buzzword you want. So honesty is what they want. And I think where people are starting to recalibrate and realise, you know what, the future isn't with the government, it's with our local community. And I think that's a story I keep trying to tell. Hey, the future is in your hands.
Really? Andrew, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Peter.
Cool. Thank you too, Dennis Prager and Andrew Hasty, for those interviews. Terrific. Really interesting chats. I learned a lot. Cool. So we'll now fly through some stories that made us laugh this week. I'll start out with this one because it is the funniest story. Constantine Reliu, man in Romania.
Good pronunciation.
Certainly hope so. Definitely better than you two. He left his family a while back to go find employment in Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
He sort of fell out of contact with his family. The wife declared him dead.
Mm.
Yeah. And then he came back to Romania and couldn't shake it from a legal perspective.
Yeah, look, as James has pointed out,
yep,
he's got a death certificate and he wants to get it overturned because you can't get a job and you can't buy anything because he's dead.
Yep.
And the court ruled him not alive.
Yeah.
Even
really?
Though he went to court.
An appeal. I'd like to appeal the fact that I'm dead. Sorry.
Yeah. See, like,
look, this form, it's signed.
Apparently he made a convincing argument, but he didn't win.
Yeah.
Which seems odd.
So, so many things I love about this story. Mm. I mean, obviously Australia's got a pretty bad red tape problem.
Yeah.
I don't think we're that bad yet.
What do you mean? So your wife can just say, yeah, you're dead.
Yeah.
And then,
well, it doesn't sound like the happiest family in the world, but yeah. I just do love the idea. It's like, look, judge, I'm standing here. I'm talking to you.
Yeah.
That is me. I am clearly not dead. This is not rigor mortis. This is not gas escape in the body.
Yeah.
I'm walking around.
Yeah. I mean, look, and Morgan Begg said...
This is what I like.
He said, what if he's an imposter? Obviously, Morgan's got a very suspicious mind. Yeah. You know, he's a dark character.
He's run afoul of a fair few Romanian imposters in his time. Look, he's been burned.
And he's a deeply troubled man, Morgan.
So friend of the podcast, Morgan Begg, for new listeners.
We should get him burned on for ages. Anyway, he was like, well, he's probably an imposter. Of course, you know. Anyway, that's all I had, actually, for that one.
Yeah, so does he have to, like...
Does he have a witness or something, like someone who can testimony that he's he?
Yeah. Well, his family must be looking after him.
Oh, probably his wife hates him already.
Well, I think he's, I don't think
that's why. That's
declaring someone dead without a lot of evidence.
Yeah.
Can I read out what he said to the local media outlet? No. I'm officially dead, although I'm alive. I've amused, Reliu told media outlets. I have no income and because I am listed dead, I can't do anything.
Wow.
But on the plus side, you do have a built-in excuse to get out of any social commitment you don't want to go to.
It's exactly.
Like, well, I'm dead.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Oh, he can proclaim himself as invisible, so he can just do whatever he wants.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
I think people can still see him. Yeah, but there's no legal...
He's alive, Nina.
but according to the government, he's dead.
Yeah.
So he's not legally abide with everything.
But people can still see him.
Anyway, we'll keep
you can't walk around committing crimes.
We'll keep you updated with what happens to Konstantin in the future. Because I don't think we've heard
his imposter.
Yeah, or his imposter. I don't think you've heard the last of this.
No.
Maybe we can interview him next week. Anyway,
it might be a Dan Brown novel.
The other thing, another thing that's come out today in Australia is that Australian nurses, a code of conduct being pushed out for Australian nurses needs them. Sorry, I just need to read the quote here.
That's okay, man. You only had all day.
A new code. Oh, well.
Wow.
Spit, you know. Okay, here we go. So it requires nurses to acknowledge white privilege when treating Indigenous patients.
It's the most important part of treating someone.
So and it applies to all 350,000 nurses and midwives in Australia. That's it. That's the story.
Yeah. So basically, like, everyone in the room has to acknowledge that they are white and have white privilege before they stop someone from choking or something like that.
Because
are we all on the same, guys? Before we help this person out, before we deliver this baby, before we bring this person back, we're all aware of all the systemic power that we all have.
Yeah, yeah, and centuries of oppression. Because, you know, racism's bad, so the best way to fight it is to make it the centre of everything we do.
Yeah, exactly. If you only by seeing race at the centre of every interaction we have, will we stop thinking about race.
Let's inject race into everything.
Exactly.
Anyway. That'll probably unfold a bit more as the days come on. But Graham Howcroft of the Nurses Professional Association of Queensland was on the TV today cracking it.
Very cool. All right, so last story we got here. So a lot of our listeners out there might be fans of the Netflix show Black Mirror. I know I am for one. You guys fans?
I get a bit too depressed when I watch it.
I haven't started yet.
Oh, really? Well,
I've really liked the couple of episodes I watched, but I was like, this is quite depressing.
Well, if you want the happy ones, you want Sanjay Napero and Hang the DJ. They're really happy. Really cool.
Like, really happy, happy.
Yeah, well, Hang the DJ is a Smith song, but anyway.
A very depressing Smith song.
It's a really good episode, and people that have seen it are now telling you it's really happy.
Okay.
Anyway, not the point. although I could. So China has now adopted as one of its policies one of the more depressing Black Mirror episodes. Mm. So you guys might know the one. It's called Downfall or Freefall or Fallout.
Not sure what it's called.
Can't remember.
But I have seen it.
Yeah, so it's the one with Bryce Dallas Howard, but she is... So it's sort of like a satire of where we're all going with like Instagram likes and Facebook likes and Twitter the faves, where every part of her life is now photographed and put online and people like it. And she has like a social credit score.
Yeah.
And as she attends a friend's wedding, it starts to decrease and decrease as her life sort of spirals out of control.
Yeah.
And eventually she can't catch a plane because it's so low. She can't catch a bus because it's so low.
Yeah.
And it's like a massive satire of how we all see each other.
Yeah, and it's not just like you can, like if you have a, like we have a conversation and you annoy me, I can give you a low rating and that affects your access to, like it's...
Yeah, exactly. It's so every, there's like a famous, like one of the scenes, it's like, oh, that wasn't a very positive interaction, so I'm going to give you a low score. And
it's so it's like a popularity...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
But basically, so the reason we're bringing this up is China's introducing this as a policy. Like China are... I've got it here. So the system, full system, will be rolled out by 2020 and will give each of the countries 1.3 billion people, this is coming from Nine News Online, a score based on their trustworthiness.
Yeah.
So government says its mission is to build a harmonious socialist society, but we're rewarding what they see as good behavior and punishing any person or company that falls short. Pete and I are in trouble, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't work for like drunk Australians on tour.
I'm definitely not getting a flight to Beijing anytime soon.
That's terrifying.
So online shopping habits will be traced. If you're spending too much on items deemed, quote, lazy, such as video games, your score should be dragged down. I'm certainly in trouble. The government look at your bills, your student records, whether or not you jaywalk. Pete and I are absolutely gone. And even whether you visit your parents enough. So
it's terrifying.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, sorry, we can't let you on the flight because you missed your mum's birthday last year.
We are like making jokes about this, but this is pretty bad.
It's pretty chilling. But the positive thing for me is like, there's no way this is going to work.
Yeah,
1.2 billion people. That is ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, in a sense, it's kind of, I mean, everyone has a, to get a little deep for the podcast, everyone has a kind of reputational score anyway, I guess.
Yeah.
But this is like the government.
Which is what Black Mirror was saying. It's like, no, this is just literally how we do things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But now the government has that and makes choices over what you do.
Yeah. It's crazy. Xi Jinping has lost it, is my brave take. So everyone's having a crack. Xi Jinping, you know.
Jinping is Xi Jinping. Do you know what Xi Jinping means in Chinese?
What?
Crazy.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Nina with the knowledge.
Not the name, but that this is a word of Xi Jinping.
This is a very cosmopolitan podcast.
And he does kind of look like Winnie the Pooh.
Yeah.
To go back to that story that was like last year. Yeah, they banned Winnie the Pooh in China because everyone kept saying you look like Winnie the Pooh.
Oh, yeah, true.
Which is how you stop getting people to say you look like Winnie the Pooh.
Yeah.
Cool, that is it for this week's show. Thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you guys so much for subscribing. And thank you to Dennis Prager and Andrew Hasty for those really interesting interviews. Part two of Dennis Prager coming next week, so make sure you guys stick around. The best way to stick around is to subscribe to us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and you can also stream it on our website and on... Hey, what did I miss? Our weekly email. And if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, that would be ace. You can also leave a comment for us, maybe a tip for the show.
Suggestion.
New
segment?
New segment ideas or just feedback in general. Tell Pete how good we are. Nina, how can people become a member?
Yeah, just visit our website, rpa.org.au, and click on the join button. And starting as low as $22 per year, you can become a member and you'll be receiving a free... 4 editions of IPA reviews and also access to weekly emails. Hey, what did I miss?
Very cool. See you guys next week.
See ya.